VOA 1 The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories, along with Jill Robbins. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare said criticism of his country's security negotiations with China was very insulting. This was his first comment on a security treaty he said was ready to sign. Last week, an early version of the security treaty became public. Several countries, including Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, have since expressed concern over the possibility of a Chinese military base in the area. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said Monday it was a possible militarization of the region. And Australia's Defense Minister, Peter Dutton, added that his country would be concerned if the deal led to a Chinese military base in the Pacific. The island nation is about 3,200 kilometers northeast of Australia. It has a population of 690,000. Sogavare told the parliament on Tuesday the leaked security document was only a draft. He would not give details about the final deal. "We are not pressured in any way by our new friends, and there is no intention whatsoever to ask China to build a military base in the Solomon Islands," he said. Sogavare criticized Western countries in the speech. He said they did not care if the island nation went underwater because of climate change. He also denied claims by opposition political groups that a security treaty with China would lead to an autocratic government. The Solomon Islands changed its diplomatic relations from Taiwan to mainland China in 2019. During anti-government riots last year, Sogavare said the Chinatown neighborhood in the capital, Honiara, was burned down. There were also threats to sports buildings for the 2023 Pacific Games being built by China. He said these buildings gifted to the Solomon Islands must be protected. Under a 2017 security agreement, Australia provided police assistance to restore order after the riots. New Zealand, Fiji, and Papua New Guinea also later sent police. The leaked document said the security treaty would permit China's armed police and military to protect Chinese projects on the islands. Sogavare rejected the idea that China was a security threat to the area. He said the nation's security treaty with Australia would stay in place. China's foreign ministry spokesman said Tuesday that its security agreement with the Solomon Islands was within international law and guidelines. But Australia and New Zealand continue to raise concerns with the island nation over the proposed security agreement with China.
Ukraine says it has received some unusual financial support in its fight against the Russian invasion. Cryptocurrency donations. People around the world have donated millions of dollars directly to Ukraine's war effort through cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin. Crypto is a digital currency that only exists online. It works as an exchange medium through computer networks that are not controlled by any bank or government. Ukrainian officials began calling for such donations in late February, shortly after Russia's invasion. Ukraine's government says it has taken in almost $67 million of its $200 million goal as of March 26. Alex Bornyakov is the country's deputy minister for digital transformation. He wrote on the nation's donation website that crypto is playing a significant role in Ukraine's defense. Ukraine has spent about $34 million of the funds received as of last week. It has turned about 80% of the donations into traditional money. It used the remainder with merchants that already accept cryptocurrencies, Bornyakov said in an email. Michael Chobanian is the founder of a Ukrainian cryptocurrency exchange. He is one of several people helping the Ukrainian government manage the donations through an informal agreement, Bornyakov confirmed. We are buying so much stuff that is saving lives every single day and also are stopping the aggression, so it's a beginning of a new world, Chobanian said in a voice message sent through the app Telegram. Chobanian said he was not receiving payment for his work, but he noted that some of the funds are being converted through his cryptocurrency exchange, Kuna. It's certainly a first, said Bennett Tomlin. He investigates cryptocurrency scams. We've never seen a sovereign nation fund their defense efforts in crypto before, Tomlin added. Officials have said that the speed with which they can use cryptocurrency donations has made them useful. The downside of such speed and ease is that cryptocurrencies are the currency of choice for criminal networks. The publicity around Ukraine's call for donations has attracted scammers, people who get money for themselves through dishonesty and trickery. Hillary Alley is a professor at American University's Law School in Washington, D.C. She has written a book about the risks of cryptocurrencies. She said anyone who donates should carefully look at all the actors involved. Who is receiving the crypto? Who will be converting the crypto? You need to be thinking about them the same way you'd be thinking about any other charity or nonprofit you are donating to, because they are intermediaries in just the same way, Ali said. Many of the donations to Ukraine's accounts can be confirmed on public tools that follow the path of cryptocurrency dealings. Tuan Fan is a cybersecurity professional. He examined the flow of money to and from some of Ukraine's accounts. He did this in part because he wanted to make a donation himself. Born in Vietnam, he said he was 8 years old when North Vietnamese communist forces took Saigon in 1975. I'm old enough to remember what happened, so I'm very empathetic to the Ukrainians, Fan said. I wanted to make sure the address where I'm sending my donation is landing in the right places. There are lots of scams going on, so you have to be extra careful.
Wordle has become one of the most popular online games in the United States since it came out last October. Players get 6 chances to guess and learn a 5-letter word for the day. Many are sharing their game results on social media, adding more interest in the game. Creative teachers have long found games could make their classes more enjoyable for students. During the pandemic, many have looked for new ways or games to help their students learn. It is part of a learning theory called gamification to keep students' interest. Beyond Wordle, here are other games that help learners with different subjects. British data scientist Richard Mann of London was talking with his daughter about the popularity of Wordle. He thought there should be a game for people who like mathematics and developed Nerdle. It is a daily game in which a player has 6 tries to guess a math solution. Does it sound familiar? Math teachers note that a Nerdle player uses logic, a careful way of thinking about something, to solve a math problem. It is similar to how a Wordle player applies logic to guess a word. Do not confuse Wordle with Worldle. There's an extra letter L in Worldle. French video game developer Antoine Touff said he invented Worldle in honor of that word game, Wordle. Players guess a country based on its shape. They get 6 tries to guess a country based on information about the country. Touff first shared the game on January 22nd. He said there are 2 million visits a day to the game's page a month later. Teachers of English see word games as a way for students to learn new words. Other word games include Blookit and Flippity. Teachers create quizzes in Blookit similar to the kinds of games students play on mobile devices. They can look at results and see areas that students can improve. In Flippity, teachers can create flashcards, rewards, spelling quizzes, memory games, and word searches from a simple Google spreadsheet. It is also a good tool for students to create their own projects. There are several online services that teachers could use to gamify learning. They include Kahoot, Quizlet, Quizzes, and Nearpod. All of them gamify learning by creating competition among learners while reviewing the content presented by teachers. In many places, teachers and students do not have a computer. So English language teacher Larry Ferlasso asked them to share their language learning games. Ferlasso wrote about them in his blog. Here are 2 of the games that teachers suggested. Danielle Horn teaches at Helena College in Glen Forest, Western Australia. She said one of the games that her students love playing is Hot or Cold. In Hot or Cold, students hide something in the classroom while a student or searcher is waiting outside. The students then say a word, phrase, or sentence. They get louder when the searcher gets nearer to the object, and softer when the searcher is more distant. Horn said to be prepared for quite a bit of noise, though. Eva Porse is a Danish high school teacher. Her students play questions and answers to learn new words or vocabulary. Porse writes words or phrases on small pieces of paper and divides students into groups of 4. Within a group, student A picks a piece of paper with a word or phrase on it and asks questions that will make student B say the exact word or phrase on the paper. For example, with the word milk, student A would ask, "What do you put on your cereal in the morning?" Student B has 1 minute to try to answer as many words or phrases as possible. The other two students in the group will then take over for 1 minute. And the team with the most correct guesses wins the game. I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell about the Korean War. The biggest problem facing Dwight Eisenhower when he became President of the United States was the continuing conflict in Korea. Eisenhower was elected in November 1952. At the time, the United States had been helping South Korea fight North Korea for more than 2 years. About 20 other members of the United Nations were also helping the South. The UN members provided troops, equipment, and medical aid.
I shall go to Korea.
During the American presidential election campaign, Eisenhower announced that he would go to Korea. He thought such a trip would help end the war. Eisenhower kept his promise. He went to Korea after he won the election, but before he was sworn in as president. Yet the fighting did not stop in Korea until July of the next year, 1953. The war started when North Korean troops invaded South Korea. Both sides believed they should control all of the country. The dream of a united Korea was a powerful one. From 1910 until World War II, Korea had been under Japanese rule. In an agreement at the end of the war, troops from the Soviet Union occupied the North. They accepted the surrender of Japanese troops and set up a military government. American troops did the same in the South. The border dividing North and South was the geographic line known as the 38th parallel. A few years later, the United Nations General Assembly ordered free elections for all of Korea. With UN help, the South established the Republic of Korea. Syngman Rhee was elected the first president. On the other side of the 38th parallel, however, Soviet troops refused to let UN election officials enter the North. The Soviet Union supported the creation of a communist government there called the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Kim Il-sung was named premier. Five years after the end of World War II, the United States had withdrawn almost all of its troops from South Korea. It was not clear if America would defend the South from attack. South Korea had an army, but it was smaller and less powerful than the North Korean army. North Korea decided the time was right to invade. On June 25, 1950, North Korean soldiers crossed the 38th parallel. The UN Security Council demanded that they go back. 2 days later, the council approved military support for South Korea. The Soviet delegate boycotted the meeting that day. If he had been present, the resolution would have been defeated. The UN demand did not stop the North Korean troops. They continued to push south. In a week, they were at the edge of the capital, Seoul. Harry Truman, America's president at that time, ordered air and sea support for South Korea. A few days later, he announced that American ground forces would also be sent. Truman wanted an American to command UN troops in Korea. The UN approved his choice, General Douglas MacArthur. Week after week, more UN forces arrived in the south. Yet by August, they had been pushed back to the Pusan perimeter. This was a battle line around an area near the city of Pusan in the southeast corner of Korea. North Korean forces attempted to break through the Pusan perimeter. They began a major attack on August 6th. They lost many men, however, and by the end of the month, they withdrew. The next month, General MacArthur directed a surprise landing of American Marines in South Korea. They arrived at the port of Incheon on the northwest coast. The landing was extremely dangerous. Water levels could rise or fall as much as 9 meters in a single day. The boats had to get close to the coastline and land at high tide. If they waited too long, the water level would drop and they would be trapped in the mud with little protection. The soldiers on the boats would be easy targets. The landing at Incheon was successful. The additional troops quickly divided the North Korean forces, which had been stretched from north to south. At the same time, UN air and sea power destroyed the Northern Army's lines of communication. On October 1st, South Korean troops entered North Korea. They captured the capital, Pyongyang. Then they moved toward the Yalu River, the border between North Korea and China. China warned against moving closer to the border. General MacArthur ordered the troops to continue their attacks. He repeatedly said he did not believe that China would enter the war in force. MacArthur was wrong. Several hundred thousand Chinese soldiers crossed into North Korea in October and November. Still, MacArthur thought the war would end by December 25th, the Christmas holiday. This was not to happen. The UN troops were forced to withdraw from Pyongyang. And by the day before Christmas, there had been a huge withdrawal by sea from the coastal city of Hongnam. In the first days of 1951, the North Koreans recaptured Seoul. The UN troops withdrew about 40 kilometers south of the city. They reorganized and 2 months later regained control of Seoul. Then the war changed. The two sides began fighting in an area north of the 38th parallel. They exchanged control of the same territory over and over again. Men were dying, but no one was winning. The cost in lives was huge. General MacArthur had wanted to enter China and attack Manchuria. He also had wanted to use nationalist Chinese troops against the communists. President Truman feared that these actions might start another world war.
If we do have another world war, it will be an atomic war. We could expect many atomic bombs to be dropped on American cities. And a single one of them could cause many more times the casualties than we have suffered in all the fighting in Korea. I do not want to be responsible for bringing that about.
When MacArthur disagreed in public with the president's policies on Korea, including the general's statement, "There is no substitute for victory," Truman dismissed MacArthur.
It was with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders, but the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual.
In June 1951, the Soviet delegate to the United Nations proposed a ceasefire for Korea. Peace talks began, first at Kaesong, then at Panmunjom. By November, hope for a settlement was strong. But negotiators could not agree about several issues, including the return of prisoners. The UN demanded that prisoners of war be permitted to choose if they wanted to go home. The different issues could not be settled after more than a year. Finally, in November 1952, the peace talks were suspended. Fighting continued during the negotiations. As it did, President Truman lost support. This was one reason why he decided not to seek re-election. The new president, Dwight Eisenhower, took office in January 1953. Eisenhower had campaigned to end the war. He was willing to take strong action to do this. Years later, he wrote that he secretly threatened to expand the war and use nuclear weapons if the Soviets did not help restart the peace talks. Such measures were not necessary. In a few months, North Korea accepted an earlier UN offer to trade prisoners who were sick or wounded. The two sides finally signed an armistice agreement on July 27, 1953. The agreement stopped the fighting and provided for the exchange of about 90,000 prisoners of war. It also permitted prisoners to choose if they wanted to go home. The war in Korea damaged almost all of the country. As many as 2 million people may have died, including many civilians. After the war, the United States provided hundreds of thousands of soldiers to help the South guard against attack from the North. Half a century has passed since the truce, yet Korea is still divided, and many of the same issues still threaten the Korean people and the world. The Korean conflict increased efforts in the United States to develop a weapon more deadly than the atomic bombs that had been used against Japan to end World War II. These efforts led to the hydrogen bomb. The Soviets were developing such a weapon, too. They had already developed and tested an atomic bomb. The 1950s found Americans at home feeling hopeful about the economic future, while also living under the threat of nuclear war.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.